We've talked ad nauseum on this show about what it's like to start a business, but what's it like to start a venture capital fund? Welcome to Venture Voice, show number 12. I'm Greg Gallant. Today we talk with Deborah Farrington. Debbie is the founder and co-chairman of Starvest Partners, a large technology venture capital fund in Manhattan. Starvest is unique for several reasons as a venture capital fund. It was started during the dot-com boom by partners who'd never worked together before. Few other venture funds of that vintage survived the dot-com bust. Starvest, however, has a number of big hits in its portfolio and is poised to leverage that success by raising a new, large venture fund for the years ahead. Starvest is the only venture fund that's managed by women. There are a few other female VCs in general, but no others who've started their own fund together. While Deborah started in finance, she's taken risks throughout her career and all over the world. Now, in the process of raising a new fund, she's in pitch mode and ready to sell all of you on working with Starvest. Enjoy. Debbie, welcome to Venture Voice.
Thank you.
So you got your career started in finance, and now you're working with entrepreneurs most of the day. What was that like in terms of starting a career, if you could walk us through it and also tell us kind of what aspects of entrepreneurship were in finance, if there were any, and how it prepared you to kind of be in this entrepreneurial world?
I'll start with the beginning of my career, because I think that laid an important foundation for what I'm doing now. After college, I went to a bank training program. This was back in the 70s, and that was what a lot of people did then, and got a firm foundation in credit analysis. Then I went to Harvard Business School, got my MBA there, and then joined Merrill Lynch as an associate in corporate finance. And I was with Merrill Lynch for a little over 10 years, both in management, in corporate finance, and I was also a securities analyst in Tokyo for a period of time. So I worked in New York, Hong Kong, and Tokyo. And that really laid a very firm foundation within finance for me. Investment banking is actually somewhat entrepreneurial, not like starting your own company, but it really requires an entrepreneurial bent to develop your own clients and really develop a book of business yourself. In addition, I was in Asia in the 80s, which was a fairly early period for being active in Asia, and that really required a focus on who would be best new business clients for a firm like Merrill Lynch for issuance, et cetera, et cetera. So that gave me, I think, a good foundation in doing lots of cold calls, et cetera, which clearly is important today in venture capital. Following Merrill Lynch, I went with a Hong Kong-based merchant bank, which is where I started doing direct equity investing, because at the time, Asian clients expected you to put down your money next to theirs if you were going to be giving them advice. So we invested in a lot of the typical Asian-based businesses, many of which were even then outsourced manufacturing. And that included firms like Flextronics, VTech, as well as real estate, textiles, et cetera, typical Asian-based firms and manufacturing businesses. And as a woman, it was really, I think, very important to get a start at name brand firms, Chase Manhattan, Merrill Lynch, Harvard Business School, because then there would be no reason for anybody ever to question any of my qualifications. So you had asked prior to this interview about some perspective as being a woman in business, so I would share that as being something that's important. I came back to the United States in the early 90s from living in Hong Kong and was running a small public company that the merchant bank controlled, was asked by a group of people that I knew from Harvard Business School that were direct equity investors to join them, which I did. And I started from scratch, really, a venture firm within that overall group. We raised $80 million. I started with a desk and a phone. Of course, it was under the umbrella of a large group, but we did raise $80 million. And that's where I started investing in business services, which has been a theme ever since within my career and is a theme of our venture fund now. I was with that other investment group from 1993 to roughly 1997 when I decided I'd like to pursue a strategy that I had identified as being one that had a lot of opportunity at the time. And this was investing in business services, which were about to become web-based and internet-based. I joined with three partners 1997, we came together in late 1997 to develop this idea after the investment company that I was with, which had agreed to back me as an entrepreneur in starting a fund, then started saying, well, why don't you do it like this and why don't you do it like that? And like many entrepreneurs, I said, no. I have a vision that I want to pursue myself. And so I did. So in 1998, four partners came together to form Starvis Partners. We were a first-time fund. We had never worked together before. So there was a fair degree of risk in that as far as limited partners were concerned. But we had a strategy that really resonated with LPs at that time. Remember what it was like in 1998 and 1999. The internet was just coming into focus in a lot of people's investment horizons. There was a lot of excitement. The bubble was really starting, and we had some very exciting IPOs. So it was a very good time to raise venture funds. We had as a goal for Starvis to raise $100 million. We ended up raising $150 million, which was the maximum that we would raise. And we got some excellent institutional investors, as well as inviting in CEOs to be investors. The idea was that they would then provide introductions to companies for our portfolio companies. The focus of the fund, and I think this was one of the things that differentiated Starvis from other funds at the time, was to invest in the convergence of business services, digital media, as we called the internet then, and information technology. So the convergence of those things, really investing in the new digital economy, we called it. And that meant e-business, business-to-business companies, business services, specifically the outsourcing of IT, enabling internet technologies. And this was really the focus of the firm, and we used all of our team's expertise. We had someone, i.e. myself, who was very experienced in business models, financial analysis, and real company analysis. One of my partners was a very experienced information technology investor, and another of my partners was a very early internet investor. So the three of us had complementary experiences, and that was how we started the firm. So that's a brief overview of my career just to the start of Starvis Partners in 1999.
Let's jump back to earlier in your career when you were on that side where you had to kind of go out and convince people to work with you and do deals. Can you remember an example of one of the toughest cold calls you had to make and a time when it was really tough for you to break in and get a certain deal or make a certain contact?
Some of the most difficult experiences I had were in Asia and cold calling on some of the customers that we had, both governments and companies. So it was hard in one sense because Merrill Lynch was trying to establish itself as a viable investment banking competitor in Asia at the time, which was 79, 80, 81. On the other hand, Asian business and Asian relationships are very hierarchically organized, so that I was a representative of a large, well-known firm. I was an officer of that firm, so that gave me some credibility. But some of the toughest, really, deals that we had were when we went in to pitch to the various governments, the government of the Philippines, various Thai entities, various Indian entities, and we had to figure out how to distinguish our firm, ourselves, because in the end, personal relationships still are very important. And if you're competing against a Goldman or Morgan Stanley, and I'm representing Merrill Lynch, these are all fine firms. So often it is the particular personal twist that you bring to it. And I think that really is a differentiating characteristic. So I would say way back then, really that was, I think those were some of the toughest things that we did.
In building those relationships, what attributes do you think were most important? Was it persistence? Was it being nice? Or was it being aggressive?
Certainly all of those things. I think persistence, aggressiveness, being able to set forth an idea in a succinct fashion and not wasting the other person's time. In advance, figuring out what it was that was important to them from a business point of view and then trying to fulfill that need. I mean, that clearly, I think, is one of the most important things. that is a kind of analysis and really intellectual probing that is important for success in any business. And I would relate that to the investment business. It's particularly important in venture capital, whether it's a product idea that a company is trying to fulfill, what need are they trying to fulfill that either hasn't been met before or they can be better than anyone else. And from a venture capital perspective with a limited partner, getting them to invest in your fund, what is it that differentiates your fund from another one? What need would you be filling that the LP has, whether it's to invest in an emerging manager or a particular strategy that you have? But it really was knowing the customer, whatever the customer is, knowing what their needs are and being able to really express ourselves succinctly and showing very quickly what the attributes were that differentiated our firm from any other.
How do you investigate that to find out what the customer needs? I mean, just at the time you can just pop on their website to see an overview of the company.
That's right.
How do you get that information?
Well, within financial services, there still is a lot of material that's available. And usually when you make an appointment, we had some idea of what the needs were. So it's research. It's some initial correspondence, obviously, with the target, whoever that is. Then obviously being able to think on your feet and being able to react to a need that they express during any kind of an interview. So it's basically be prepared. And the last 20 plus years, nothing has changed from that. Go in, know as much about the entity or the person that you're talking to as possible, and go from there.
Jumping from there, how did you use those strategies to raise your own fund? As you were saying, that was a big step to kind of go from being within some kind of corporate structure to breaking out and being independent. How big a challenge was it to convince the limited partners to invest in your fund?
We were a first-time fund, and we had never worked together before. So that is about as large a challenge as you could imagine when trying to fundraise within venture capital. We did have individual track records ourselves that had been impressive within the areas of our specialty. So that was very, very important. We also provided potential large investors with evidence that people that we had known in our prior lives were willing to back us. What we did as a firm was we spent a year and a half preparing our strategy, laying the groundwork prior to our first closing. We got four entities that each of us had known in our prior lives to come in and to provide the money to back our firm while we were fundraising. In exchange for those sort of almost $2 million, we gave up a part of our carry early so that we knew in order to get in the game, we had to give up something. We don't have to do that today, but at the time, we were willing to give up part of our carry in order to do that. And when larger investors saw that some very sophisticated people that had known us in prior lives, they were both institutions as well as successful entrepreneurs, had agreed to back us, put up money really with no recourse, and then each of those had also agreed to be an anchor investor of several million dollars in the fund. So that was a very important step forward. We also had an incredibly well thought out and articulated strategy, which was based on both original research and actual investment experience. In the early to mid-90s, business services, whether it was staffing, whether it was IT consulting, which was the classic outsourcing, was not really considered a classic area of investment for venture capitalists. It wasn't hard technology, etc. So this business services was a softer area. We identified, I think, a great need. One of my personal hits was a company that we invested in at 37 cents and ended up selling for $10 a share. That was at my former firm. So we showed that there could be tremendous returns within the business services area. And so, of course, that ended up becoming a very popular area for venture capital investments in the late 90s and then really morphed into more of an IT-oriented, web-based really business opportunity in sort of the new millennia, 2000, post-2000. But back to summarize, to answer your question, It was getting people that knew us well, who were respected, to make a little investment and to really put a stake in the ground and say, I believe in this new group. It was having an incredibly well-articulated strategy backed up by a lot of research, as well as personal experience where we've been successful in investing. So that was really it. And also, let's face it, luck generally plays a role as well. And it was a super time for fundraising. It was 1998 and 1999. We had the first closing of our fund in July 1999, which was right in the middle of the bubble. And we had our final closing in actually the fourth quarter of 2000. We just squeaked in under the wire, I think, of fundraising. So that was really how we did it.
Do you think if you raised the fund earlier, you might have been tempted to make some unwise investments, as many did in that time?
I am sure that we would have been tempted. One of the things that went very well for our fund is that we did start investing in 1999. We made one investment in 1999 because we could not find anything that met our criteria. Everything was overpriced, it wasn't developed, there were a lot of ideas hunting for funding. We were extremely disciplined. In 2000, we kept to the same discipline, although we did invest more. But often we asked ourselves, what's wrong with us? Everybody else is investing all their money, we've hardly made any investments. What's wrong with us? Is it because we're a new group? And anyway, it was actually interesting when I look back on those days. When we say what was wrong with us, it actually was a very prudent approach to investing, where we consciously tried to stick to our plan. And the result was that at the end of 2000, when many funds that had raised their money in 99 and 2000 were 75% invested, and generally three quarters of that was in disasters, with the money never to be seen and never to be returned to the LPs, we had still really only put out probably about a quarter of our fund. So we slowed down and then really were very careful about the pace of our investing. And we actually wrote off, I would say, two-thirds of the investments that we made in 99 and 2000, progressed to make many more investments in 2000, 2001, 2002, etc. And I would say 90% of those investments will be good and will return capital. So I'm very pleased about that.
Congratulations.
Yes, I'm quite pleased about that. We expect to have a very positive return of capital. And we have an 8% hurdle rate for our fund, which was a fairly tough term. Our anchor investor insisted on that. It's one of the requirements that they have, and as a first-time fund, we really had little choice but to agree to that.
How exactly do those terms work with the 8%?
Well, the terms work like this. Our anchor investor, who put up 25% of the money for the $150 million, which is a large chunk of change when you're trying to raise $150 million, had very specific requirements, which were not easy. We had to put up 5% cash for the GP. So for a $150 million fund, we had to put up $7.5 million. And again, that was what some of our anchor investors helped us provide in exchange, as I mentioned before, for an interest in the GP. And then we had an 8% hurdle rate, which requires an 8% compounded rate of return on capital committed prior to the GP getting anything back. So those are pretty tough terms for venture capitalists, but they were ones that we could live with, and we do at this point envision and project returning that that hurdle rate, which for a 1999 fund will be rather spectacular. We expect to end up in the top quartile. But rather than having all of our money invested in 3.5 years and having it all returned in 5.5 years, this has been a very difficult cycle. We will have invested all of our money in approximately 6 years, and we'll expect it to be returned probably in 7 to 8. The average life of an investment for our fund will probably be about 4 years. But the largest companies definitely require 5 to 6 to 7 years to build, and there's really nothing to get around that. That's back to the classic cycle of venture capital, and it takes 5 to 7 years to build a business. One of our most successful companies is called NetSuite. It was one of our first investments. that we made in 2000. And it's interesting because I think sourcing is another challenge for venture capitalists, and we can talk about that in a minute. But I'll use this as an anecdote because I think it's instructive on the building company front. NetSuite was brought to me by one of my colleagues at Harvard Business School, a section mate. He happened to be the CEO. The company was founded by Larry Ellison, one of the star programmers at Oracle. So my friend called and said, would you like a chance to invest in a company founded by Larry Ellison? And I, with stars in my eyes, said, absolutely. It was wonderful. And when he approached us, he said, Debbie, you're about the only venture capitalist that I know that I think is really smart, but also nice. So I'd like to work with you. And I said, terrific. So we went in, committed a fairly large amount for our firm at the time, about $6.7 million. This was early in 2000. Of course, that was still when valuations were very high, et cetera. And we went in, committed our money. The company had zero revenues. It was software as a service. So we were a very, very early investor in software as a service. That is Salesforce.com, which many people know is software as a service, where you buy the software by paying on a quarterly, monthly, or annual basis. It's not a license basis. But we went in, committed to that. We couldn't get any West Coast VCs to come with us. They said, software as a service, this little company, Larry Ellison, the chairman, what can we add? Larry has a difficult reputation, et cetera, et cetera. So we went in with two other smaller East Coast firms, and this will be probably our most successful investment. It started from zero. It has GAAP revenues of over $40 million this year, bookings of 1.5 times that. We'll be going public next year on revenues that are marching toward $100 million. Larry Ellison has been an absolute visionary. He was the one that really talked about software as a service and was absolutely spectacular. At the risk of going on too long on this subject, I do want to share something that I think will be somewhat amusing for the listeners, and that's an analogy which really explains why software as a service is interesting, but also why an integrated suite of applications is interesting, which is what NetSuite is. It starts with the general ledger, has CRM and ERP, so that a small and medium-sized business can run their business totally online. And as Larry likes to say, well, you don't buy a car where you buy a steering wheel from one person, an engine from another, and then you put it together and hire someone to wire it all together. No, you buy a finished car. You might buy a Toyota or you might buy a BMW, but you buy the finished car. So I think that's a very interesting analogy with respect to buying little pieces of software. It's rather simplistic, but it always amuses me.
Being nice paid off?
Yes, it did. Being nice paid off to get into the deal. And being nice is probably the wrong label. I think being pleasant to work with is important. And I know in previous interviews that you've had, there's been emphasis placed on the relationship that you have between venture capital and company. And that's a very important relationship. I think the advice that we give companies when they come to us and are interviewing us as a prospective investor in their company is to focus on the relationship between the venture investor and the CEO and the rest of the company. Are they going to be a value-added partner? When things get tough, which they almost inevitably do at some point or another, at some point a business plan will not go according to plan. So you want to know, is the person who's investing in your company willing to support you, certainly within reason, if a company's going south and you have to make the very tough decision to stop supporting it, that's another decision. But you want someone who's going to be a partner who will help you, who will make customer introductions for you, who will really provide advice and counsel for you as an entrepreneur. So that's the long answer to your question, did being nice pay off? And I would say yes. Being nice, being tough, being intellectually rigorous, I think all of those things are very important.
I noticed on your bio that you often end up with the chairman title or at least a spot on the board. How do you work with that in terms of being hands-on, but where do you draw the line in terms of involvement that is a reason that you're not also the CEO?
We generally take board seats because we find that that is the best way to monitor the investment, and we have a fiduciary duty to our LPs, of course, to do that. It's also the best way to be involved with the company and to provide value added. I have been the chairman of a company before. I was at my prior firm. I was the chairman of a staffing firm, actually business within the business services category. It grew from $17 million to $250 million in revenues. That was the large hit that I mentioned before, where we made about 25 times our money. But in this fund, we often don't become the chairman, whereas we do become very active investors. Being the chairman is another level of commitment, and when you have 23 companies in the portfolio, as we do now, it's hard to be a chairman of a company, although we would not rule that out. But being active investors on the board is important. What we don't want to do is micromanage within divisions. What we do want to do is provide broad strategic guidance. We also are very helpful in providing very specific guidance in terms of the type of profile of person that should be hired as the head of sales, the head of biz dev, helping with very tough decisions on when do you change out a CEO, a CFO, a head of sales. When do you make those very tough calls? And by the way, those are some of the toughest calls we've made, but I'll also tell you it's a very frequent call that a venture capitalist has to make. I think we recently analyzed several months ago how many CEOs we had changed out, and the answer was the majority of our companies have CEOs that they did not start with. A couple of them have had two, but that's when there's very rapid growth. And you've heard the old saying that the entrepreneur who founds a company often is not the one that can scale it. And we have found that generally to be true. NetSuite has gone through really three CEOs, one that was the CEO very early on, the other that was very strong in technology when the product was being built, and then a CEO that came in to really take it from $8 million in revenues up to 40 and beyond to 100. And he's the marketing CEO. So we do have to change out management. That's a very tough call. And then we also will help in providing advice and in choosing financial management packages. So there is some very detailed work that goes on, some very close work that goes on with the company. So I'd say we really do run the gamut from broad strategic advice down to actually hiring advice. We don't go down more than probably the second level. We would not interview somebody to work for the head of marketing, for example, but we do go down to that first level that reports to the CEO. We also do help with customer introductions. That's, I think, a very important part of value added. I think a lot of venture capitalists don't focus on that enough, because if you look around and you say, what does a young company need? They need customers. And often they don't have either the experience or the firepower to get into the C-level, the chief marketing officer, the chief investment officer, really the level that they need, or just one level below that. So with our firm being based in New York City, and many venture firms are based in Boston or Silicon Valley, those are the classic places for venture funds to be located. We are located in New York, so we have particularly strong relationships with financial institutions, retail, media, and then information technology, joint venture partners. Those are the four things which we feel that we're particularly strong on, being New York-based and with the experience of our firm. We've been quite successful in making customer introductions for our companies.
There are many famous examples of entrepreneurs who have scaled, maybe the exceptions, but you've got Dell, you've of course got Bill Gates and
Steve Jobs. Started, left, came back.
Yeah, that's quite one of the famous cases. So what do all of these entrepreneurs have that the entrepreneur CEOs that you've replaced didn't have?
Well, let's start with the obvious. They're absolutely extraordinary business minds, for one thing. And with the case of Bill Gates, he was an extraordinary technologist. I think these people also were very skilled at bringing in other management at just the right time. And I do think that one thing that our CEOs that have stayed in the position have in common is that they understood when to bring in the right people at the right time that helped to scale the business. Bill Gates certainly has had extremely strong CEOs working for him. They've been very successful. I think Michael Dell is a very interesting example of somebody who I think, was able to do it all. Strong CEO, brilliant business idea. Really, he was the equivalent of Henry Ford in terms of the computer business. And I think that that's what those people have in common with Steve. Steve Jobs, the board, I think, threw him out at one point, brought in somebody else who had more business experience, and then again, as Larry Ellison would say, because Larry and Steve were best friends, the technology vision really had to triumph yet again. And you can see the tremendous innovation that Apple has really succeeded with under Steve again, iPod, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that it's a challenge for venture investors to make these decisions about people, and we're not always right, of course, but you can often tell when you go into an investment who the founders and CEOs are that will make it and who are the ones that will not. So I think that it's the ability to judge a person's skills, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with being a very successful founder, CEO. We have funded serial entrepreneurs, and they're people who absolutely excel at going in, starting something up, and then need to turn it over to something else that can scale. More often, we've seen companies fail because a founding CEO either refuses to turn over the reins to another CEO that has other qualifications, or the venture investors don't act soon enough to do that. I think that's been, if we've had a failing as a firm, I think it's been not changing out a CEO soon enough and perhaps continuing to fund companies when we really shouldn't have. We've had a few out-and-out mistakes from the get-go. Thank goodness, not too many of those. But when we've been mistaken, where we've had write-offs, it has been more continuing to fund when a business just wasn't. When the dog wasn't hunting in the first 12 to 18 months, that's, I think, when we've made our mistake, or tried to merge that with another company, or really sat down at the drawing boards and said, this company isn't working. Perhaps it was an industry that had very slow adoption, or perhaps the product just was not either broad enough or not competitive enough.
So if you're in your conference room and you've got a really hot company, you like everything that this entrepreneur has built, but there's a serious doubt in your mind that this entrepreneur can go on and be the best CEO for the company, do you tell them before you invest there's a good chance we're going to replace you, or
yes,
do you get the money in?
No, we do. We often tell them in advance, because if someone is not able to, I think, understand their own weaknesses and the limits of what they can do, you're often going to have a problem with that CEO, which can be obviously a very disruptive force within a company that otherwise could do well, or you have a cultural problem. And some companies never recover from cultural problems. That's something that we've also learned. In an investment that we're just going to make now, we're planning to close it this week, we have told the CEO from the beginning, we may be changing you, so you need to understand that. Now, this individual funded the company after the closing, will own 26% of the common stock, so he has put in certain provisions within the investor rights document and within the charter that if he is no longer CEO, there's a provision for us to expand the board from 5 to 7, and he is able to elect 2 members to the board of directors representing the common stock, presumably one of whom will be him when he no longer is the CEO. So there are ways to come to a meeting of the minds in advance with an entrepreneur who has a wonderful product, who we think can take the company to a certain stage, and then we'll have to change out the CEO. So there are a couple of structural things that not all venture firms would be amenable to, but we are amenable to this because it has a very interesting particular technology, a very interesting 5-year contract from a buyer who will enable the company to go up to $10 million in revenues just on the strength of that contract. And what I also did was I asked a very experienced person in that sector to come in and be the chairman from the start. So what I did was we have the CEO, we've told him, you know, you're terrific now, but we please be prepared that we may have to replace you. We have a chairman who grew a company in the sector. He founded it, went through venture financing, took it public, and then sold it for $500 million over a process of about 12 years. So he's very experienced both on the venture side, on the growth side, and on the sales side. And this type of wisdom that that person brings is really irreplaceable. So I would offer that as advice both to entrepreneurs. Surround yourself with the most experienced people that you can, and also with venture investors. If there's a potential problem with the CEO, then look at the route of bringing in an experienced chairman from the beginning, ideally one who has a stake in the ground, has invested in the company as well. So we've utilized that in a couple of examples for our companies, and it's worked out very well.
You mentioned that one of the reasons you started this firm when you had that entrepreneurial itch was that you wanted the control to kind of set your own course,
yes,
you know, define your destiny, control mm-hmm. the strategy. How do you get entrepreneurs to give up control, and how worried should entrepreneurs be about giving up control of their companies that they've been working on to outsiders who happen to have the money?
That is the tough question that I think entrepreneurs have to face. Based on my own experience at the time that I decided that I had a vision that I wanted to pursue, that I could pursue better than the old entity that I was with and the older people that I worked for at the time, it was the right time in my life. It was the right time in my career. I had substantial experience. I had gone from progressively larger firms to smaller firms that I had been running. I had been the CEO of an investment firm. I've been the COO of a public company. So I had substantial experience, and for me, it was now or never. So I had a lot of experience within the area that I wanted to start this business in. So that was very important. I also had partners. I had a partnership. So it wasn't just me. There were four very experienced people. And when we started, we also had an infrastructure that we had in mind to build. We had a CFO already identified. We had a very experienced attorney who had some very good support system. So we came as a fully structured firm that was able to come in and scale right away. And I'm very proud to say that 8 years later, we have all the same people here. We had two of the younger people that had left, and we have one partner that will not be part of the second fund, but 8 years later, we have the same people. So it shows that we did a lot of good planning. We look for the same type of planning with entrepreneurs that we're going to work with. We don't do too many early stage ventures. Within our portfolio of about 23 companies, I would say that very early stage, we probably have five or six. So perhaps a quarter of the companies had no revenues when we started, or middle, you know, fewer revenues. I have to go back and check the numbers. It could be more than that, but I think probably just about a quarter of the companies. So we talk to the entrepreneurs, and we are very careful that they have a vision. We generally invest with not just one person, but with at least the skeleton of a team. That could be either the CEO, head of sales, or head of marketing, a business development person that's really stellar, a super CFO that understands and can help the CEO really define the business model. So we look for a CEO and prospective entrepreneur that we're going to back who has an idea of how to build an organization. We look for a product that is generally completed or almost completed. So we rarely do brand new technology that we would back. We do technology that might be a variation on a theme, a more developed technology, or simply a better mousetrap. So that's one, I think, way that we go about making that determination. In terms of giving up control, we look for the CEO to have certainly an ownership stake, but generally by the time that we invest, the CEO will rarely have more than 20 to 25% of the firm, and will often go through subsequent financings where a CEO might end up with 10% of the firm.
So it's got to, I guess they have to start thinking of very high stakes to cash their business out for a good amount of with that little slice of equity.
That's exactly right. It sounds like a little slice of equity, but one of the things that we ask an entrepreneur, the entrepreneur that founded NetSuite, for example, we expect it to go public with a $500 million IPO at least and go on from there. Salesforce.com went public in June of 2004, just under $1 billion valuation, and is now valued at $2.6 billion. Of course, they've grown in sales, etc., but that valuation now is roughly 8 times revenues and 100 times prospective net income for fiscal year ending 2006, which is January 1. So it depends on the scale. If you have 10% of $1 billion, that's not too shabby. If you have 20% or 15% of something that's sold for $150 million, that's also something that people find very rewarding. But what we find with entrepreneurs that we back is it's often not the financial reward that motivates them the most. It is building something that is lasting, that makes a mark in the sector that they've chosen. We're in a payroll services company. This fellow owns a fair chunk of the firm, but his main objective is to develop the best web-based payroll services company in the world, and he's well on his way to doing that. We have another investor in a spend management space that started out in human resources. His goal is to make an application that people use and that Fortune 500 companies come to rely on. He now has 20 Fortune 500 companies as major clients. That's a major success to him. Another entrepreneur who stands to make probably in the end $80+ million from his stake in one of our firms, when I asked him the question, what is it that you really want to accomplish? His answer was, I want to build software that lasts and that people use, that lots of people use. He didn't say, I want to get rich, although he does want that. He wants his name to be on software that lots of people use and lots of small and medium-sized businesses use because it makes a difference in the way they conduct their business. So it's not just money, it's that vision of building something and being proud to build it, of building a team and building a company that lasts, and being proud of that. So it's that motivation that people really look for.
So to those entrepreneurs out there who have that vision and also maybe envision some of your firm's money in their company, how do you recommend in general that they pitch and to you specifically?
If it's just an idea, I would recommend that they don't pitch to us because we won't fund it. I think the business of funding ideas is very specialized. I think a few firms might do that. A lot of firms used to do it pre-bubble and in the bubble, and not as many anymore. What we look for is an entrepreneur who has some experience in the sector that they intend to start the venture in, either in a large company where they ran a division, or better yet, in a prior company that was in that sector. In fact, we're funding someone now who had a prior company that failed, but we think it's terrific because he learned on somebody else's nickel. We know he won't repeat a lot of the same mistakes, and he's added to his product and developed it substantially. So that's another example of someone that we would back. We look to someone who we think can at least get the company to the first $5 to $10 million. So they have to know how to put an organization in place, as well as completely understanding how this product will be sold. That could be a CEO that has a technical partner who's helped them with the technology, or it could be a CEO who has developed the technology themselves. So again, it's a product that really works, a vision of how that technology will be used by customers. It's again back to what I said earlier in the interview, understanding the need and how it fits, because that's really the key to commercializing the product. And that's obviously critical if you're going to make money. Understand why people will buy it, and importantly, how they will buy it, how you sell it. And then an understanding of how to build at least a nascent organization, how to put those important people in place.
Do you take people seriously if they send you an email and make a cold call, or do you just delete those and wait for some one of your friends to introduce them to you?
Cold calls, to be absolutely truthful, are tough. We get so many business plans that if someone that we respect refers a business plan to us, or is perhaps one of the firms that we've invested in, if they refer us, then that's something that we really pay very close attention to. If one of our investors who has a history of financing successful companies refers something to us, we'll look at it very seriously. If a venture firm that we've worked for before asks us to take a look at something, we'll look at it very, very seriously. And I think I said LPs. So generally, if some spoke in the wheel that you're the hub of refers something to you, you'll look at it. If there's something in a sector that I have a particular interest in, and someone sends me an email saying, I noticed that you've been an investor in such and such, and I have developed a product and have started a company that takes this product, this service, or this idea to the next level, or provides a link with that particular product, then I also will take a look at it. I try to at least take a quick look at every email. Oh, that's in the such and such sector. If I have no interest or no experience in that, we'll delete it. If I think one of my partners has it, I'll quickly send it over to them. You know, generally, you can learn something by looking at any sort of well-thought-out business plan. If it's not well-thought-out, that's a delete. But generally, because of the sheer volume, we do look for some sort of connection that means that it is generally a good referral.
Have you ever made an investment that was prompted by that well-thought-out email or some other kind of introduction?
That is a very good question, and let me just quickly take a look at our list here. The quick answer that comes to mind is I can't think of any right off the bat, but let me just double check. There were some early ideas that came in that we felt were pretty good, but in general, the cold call email is very hard to get funded. So I would say, in general, the answer is no.
What are some options for entrepreneurs who they know they have that great idea, you can scale it up real big, but you know, they've talked to everyone in their family and their college alumni, they just haven't been able to get that good introduction?
Well, you're talking very, very early stage companies. And again, we don't do very, very early stage companies. But I would pursue those contacts, because in general, the world is a very small place. I definitely believe in 6 degrees of separation. So that an entrepreneur who is at the stage of his or her career where she has experience in a sector, has enough management experience where a person feels now's the time, generally will know someone from their old firm. And networking is a very important part of being successful in business. So in order to network successfully, I think that's an important indication of, are you going to be successful? So using the network of prior firms, whether it's business school or college contacts, whether it's family or friends, just keep expanding the scope of your contacts so that there is an introduction. Perhaps you worked in a large division or vice president of a technology company, then generally perhaps that vice president may know somebody, either a customer or someone along the way, who has a contact with a venture investor. A lot of the corporations, particularly the technology companies, still have corporate investing arms that are active. So that would be one way to keep working on the networks. But I think if someone has absolutely no experience and no network, the chances of that person being successful are probably not that high. So I think you'd want to ask yourself, am I doing this at the right time? Maybe I ought to still get a few more years experience with another firm before I try my own idea. Now then, you can look at Google and look at those two amazingly successful people. They had, I think, sort of the Stanford network behind them, and that's how they got to Kleiner Perkins. So I think that that's an example of successfully using a network. You have to be able to do something successful to be a credible risk for a venture firm to be able to back, in my view.
You're one of only a handful of women in venture capital or being a venture capitalist, and I don't know if Starvest is the only fund that's pretty much run by women. Why do you think that is?
We are asked that a lot, and we are three women partners here. We are a majority women-owned firm. We will be all women-owned for our second fund. And because I've been the only woman so frequently in my career, I really don't focus about it or think about it that much anymore. When I went to Harvard Business School, there were 10% women. When I joined Merrill Lynch in investment banking, there was a minority of women. I think one of the things is that I've always had an entrepreneurial streak, and I've always liked doing very challenging things. I've always liked being a pioneer. So that is one quick answer, and I would say that my partners would probably give you a very similar answer. I think that there aren't more women venture capitalists because in order to be a successful venture capitalist and be a partner in a firm and to start a firm, you need to have a certain degree of experience in either information technology, venture capital at another firm, financial services, so that the amount of experience that you need to start your own firm is probably 15 to 20 years, so that it definitely takes a period of time to develop the requisite experience, the requisite contacts, and for people to have confidence in you, because ultimately as a venture capitalist you are a fiduciary. So that in a past life I had done private placements, so that I knew a lot of investors in venture type investments. I was at Merrill Lynch. We have the former chairman and vice chairman as investors in our firm. So we have people that knew what we had done before who had confidence in us. I think there definitely will be more women venture partners. You're seeing more of them now. I think that in general, just as a little bit of advice to women, probably the easiest place to start is with a very large established firm where you can go in and get a lot of experience. I started in large established firms, as did all of my partners. One of my partners was with AT&T. She was then with a very successful venture firm where she actually did window on technology investing for many years and was very successful. My other partner was with a very large well-known investment bank, then became a financial journalist, and then was an early internet entrepreneur. And so that's how she got her experience, and then founded a small venture firm and had an advisory council, and some of those members of her advisory council became our LPs. People like Mario Gabelli, well-known names like that. So that's an example of how we as women did it, and that is advice that I would give. You'll start seeing more women. We're seeing them already. We're seeing women venture partners. But this is a very tough business, and I've always gravitated toward things that I thought were difficult to do, perhaps something perverse in my personality that always wanted, I always wanted to do the hardest thing and be successful at doing the hardest thing. But the venture business is a tough business. That said, it's the most exciting, most interesting thing that I have ever done because it draws on all of the skills that I've had to develop during my business career. Strategic thinking, financial analysis, actual execution, people calls, the whole human resource side of business. So it's very, very, very fascinating, and also having the ability to sit back and to say, what is going to be the next new thing? What is it that is going to change people's lives? What can we invest in that will really make an impact on this world? If you think about it, that's an amazing thing to be able to do. I couldn't imagine anything that I'd rather be doing with my professional career than doing things like that. Venture investing is a real luxury from that perspective. It's very tough in terms of finding companies. It's now, with all of the technological tools at our disposal, it's virtually a 24-hour-a-day business. But when you love what you do, it's not a burden. I don't mind waking up and first thing looking at the emails that have come in and answering them, whether it's a business problem, an LP with a question. And so again, I think it's a theme that entrepreneurs have in common. They love what they do, and it's not work, ultimately. I come to work every day. I look forward to it. It's terrific.
Of everyone in your network and everyone who believed in you professionally and who you could work with. Was it a coincidence that the two you chose to partner with to start this firm were also women?
It was a pure coincidence. We really didn't think about it at all, and I think it just is, it goes to show that luck does play a part in things. I had known one of my partners for many years. We had been tennis partners. She's a great tennis player. She and I played tennis together. I had acted as an informal mentor to her because she's about 10 years younger than I was. So I really observed what she built. And when I was ready to go out on my own and had a vision, she said, I'm looking at starting my own fund and I'm talking to so-and-so. So I said, oh, I know him. And so we brought him in. And then she also knew the person who became our fourth partner, who was a superb and very experienced window on technology investor who happens to be fearless about new technologies, whether it's security, search, et cetera, et cetera. And it just so happened that the chemistry worked and that the complementary skills worked. We also have a very collegial, really, style to our investing. We all have to agree. There's always a champion. And we're all highly civil to each other. We respect each other. And there's not a lot of testosterone going on, a lot of egos. We simply focus on what is going to be the best investment. And we don't focus so much on, well, this is mine and I'm responsible for creating, you know, more value than anybody else. That's just not part of the card. So politics completely leaves the room. Testosterone completely leaves the room. Although obviously being tough and aggressive is very, very important. But it's a long answer to say that it was not a factor. But now that we are three women, I think it's been absolutely terrific. It's the only time in my career where I've worked with the majority of women, and I really enjoy it. I think the one advantage it brings us as venture investors is that no one forgets us. We go to a meeting with LPs. That's one point of differentiation. Three attractive women walk in and nobody forgets you. And we're the only firm that all women walk in. I think with respect to working with companies, we're viewed as user-friendly. Again, we try to leave our egos at the door. It doesn't become a contest of wills. It becomes really clarity of looking at a company to make the right decision and bringing resources to bear that will be helpful, again, particularly in the area of company introductions or people introductions, new head of sales, etc.
So there's no testosterone in the firm, but how much testosterone is there in your portfolio?
That's a good question. We are three women partners, but right now most of our support people, our CFO, our attorney, etc., are men, and it works out great. They happen to be older than we are, so it's actually a pretty interesting combination of people that has just been very, very successful. All of our portfolios are headed by men except one. And again, it's really just not an issue. They're men, we're women. It really just doesn't enter into it because we're all focused on the same thing. We're focused on creating value, focused on being as helpful as possible. When you're as experienced as the three of us are, you're used to being the only woman sitting in a boardroom with men, and you learn how to be effective. And that's all there is to it. Because if you don't learn how to be effective, you won't be effective, and they will make very short work of you.
You're a very active Harvard alumni.
Yes.
What were your thoughts on the whole controversy that your president started, Summers?
I am an active Harvard Business School alumni. I'm much closer to the dean of Harvard Business School than I am to Larry Summers. That is a controversy that I think, unfortunately, has not benefited either Harvard or Larry Summers. I think that my view is that when you are in as public a position as Larry Summers is, that nothing is ever off the record. And I think that's an important lesson for probably everybody to learn, whether it's in an interview such as this, or whether you're a CEO of a company, or the head of a university. I think that's very important to remember. That said, I think he's entitled to his views. I think that those views in that forum probably were not very well chosen. And unfortunately, it's a controversy that that has hurt his presidency, has not strengthened his presidency, and has not strengthened Harvard as an institution. That said, I think Harvard is such a wonderful institution with worldwide reach that it certainly will get over this. I think that I generally feel that if people think they've made a mistake, they should apologize once and get on with it or defend themselves, and that's it. I think multiple mea culpas serve absolutely no purpose and keep focused on the controversy. So my advice to Larry is, remember, you're never off the record. Remember that if you have controversial views, you might have someone else voice them or have different data to back it up. And if you make a mistake, don't go through mea culpas. Issue it once and move on.
A lot of people criticize his style. It seems though there's a big kind of question in business and science now to explain the discrepancy between men and women active in it, you know, the difference in male entrepreneurs to female entrepreneurs, to the people who get funded, to the scientists out there. Would you venture, you know, your guess or your hypothesis as to why there is that discrepancy or what the leading cause of it is?
Well, I think the whole gender argument is overdone, so let's start there. I don't think it's worth spending too much time on. I think men do some things well, women do some things well, and the idea of building a company or building a firm is to draw on people who have complementary experiences and can complement each other. And that often means both women and men, and I think the idea is to put together the right mix that works for your company. And I think that gender, again, I would say the gender thing, as I would call it, is perhaps overdone. That said, I'm active in supporting women's causes. I've started a women's gift for Harvard Business School because I think that, for example, at an institution like that, they needed more research on women in cases. So I helped fund a movement that would fund more women research there. I think that there are things that are like that need some rectification in our society. So I think that's important. But again, I think if someone or an entity, an organization, a company, a venture capital firm feels that they have certain skills that need to be complemented, that's the best way to approach it. That said, just repeat, I'm always willing and perhaps would be more willing to take a meeting if two things were equal and there was a man and a woman with a company that I had only limited time to see. I'd probably say to the woman entrepreneur, come on in and I'll talk to you. So that might be the one bias that I would admit to in my own behavior, but that's it.
And that was on the record.
Yes, that's on the record. That's fine.
So my last gender question then, mm-hmm. not to overdo it, but
okay.
I notice in your bio and in the bio of many other women that I've read, when they take the top position, they call it chairman,
yes.
not chairwoman or chairperson. Yep. Why is that?
Well, again, let's leave the gender discussion behind. It's something I've never been very attuned to, and you're used to seeing chairman rather than chairwoman. I mean, why focus on it? It's just, you know, get on with it, and let's focus on the things that are really important.
Great. So moving forward, what's in store for Starbest? Both which portfolio companies are we going to be reading about on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, and then what's next for your partnership?
I am so glad you asked the question. Let's start with the companies first, because that's the really fun part of this business. We have three fantastic companies that have really scaled and are in the 40, 50 million plus revenue range now, and I am really, really proud of that because each of those were single figures or less in terms of millions when we started, and with respect to NetSuite was zero. The big companies that we think you'll be hearing about in the next year or two are NetSuite, which intends to go public, filing mid-06. That's the company that I alluded to before that Larry Ellison founded along with Evan Goldberg. The second company is Newgistics, which is a large reverse logistics company based in Austin, Texas, that we are in with Austin Ventures. That has scaled fantastically and will have close to 100 million in bookings this year. A third large one is Comparison Market, which owns the domain name insurance.com, under which most of its branding goes. This is the largest insurance agent on the web. You type in auto insurance on Google and up comes insurance.com. It's a comparative insurance engine where 12 or 14 different carriers will quote an auto insurance quote for you after you fill out a questionnaire. They'll return four quotes in 45 seconds. You can bind online or in a call center. And that company is growing very, very rapidly and is now the largest independent insurance agent in the country. I'm proud of that because there was no other venture investor when we went into it. We just completed a financing. It was a very hotly contested financing among venture firms, and that company is planning to go public in mid-2007, although we've had overtures about buying it already, so I don't know if it'll last that long. Some of the smaller companies that we think you'll hear about are Mazu, which is Boston-based, which is a very interesting security firm, MessageOne, which is an email restore firm, which is a very, very interesting company, Fieldglass, based in Chicago, which has a software solution that enables company to manage their contract workers, Blazant out on the West Coast, which is a company that helps large Fortune 500 companies manage their hardware and software assets. So I think those are some of the companies that you'll be hearing about. We expect the companies after the first three that I mentioned probably to be acquisitions of companies like Symantec, et cetera, et cetera. So we think that those are some of the ones that you'll be hearing about, and we're very proud of those. In terms of StarVest, we plan to raise our second fund in 2006. Our first fund was $150 million, as I said, and the cycle was much longer than we anticipated when we closed our fund in 1999 and 2000. So instead of a three-year cycle, it's been a six-year cycle. Our goal for raising money is $200 million. We expect some more exits next year, so we think that that is definitely an achievable number because already our two largest investors have committed to our fund, so we're very pleased about that.
You mentioned one of the really strong tools in starting your first fund was having that good research as a foundation and then a clear strategy for how you're going to move along that led to your discipline. What's your strategy for the next fund, and where do you see the opportunity out there?
Our strategy will be to maintain our similar investing style, which is generally to invest in B and C rounds, to go in with an investment, depending on the development of the company, anywhere 2, 3, or 4 million, and eventually go up to probably on average about 7 or 8 million, although our largest investment in this fund is with 12, 13, 14 million, and we would expect that that would be the case in the second fund as well. So we'll keep our investing style in terms of similar size and stage of company that we invest in. In terms of the types of companies, we're focused on e-commerce, which we feel there are still opportunities in, as well as enabling technologies for e-commerce, business services investments, such as NetSuite, which is an integrated application that enables small, medium-sized businesses to run their business totally online, the web-based payroll services. But we're also looking outward, and we're trying to think about what will be the technologies and the applications of those technologies. Again, we're much more oriented toward applied technologies and the application of existing technologies than backing brand new technologies. What will be the applications that will provide a change in the world in terms of the way that large corporations work? And we also have this beachhead in small to medium-sized businesses, which we focused on, as well as some e-commerce plays. So what will happen that will change things? Our investment in Comparison Market, i.e. insurance.com, enables people to buy a commodity, auto insurance, in a new way. They'll end up adding other insurance. So that's a brand new approach to be able to bind online with four quotes in 45 seconds. That's defensible technology, which is game-changing. To enable companies to track hardware and software from one spot, if you're a large multinational company that has 50 locations and has 20,000 computers, there's a real advantage to tracking that from a central spot. So what is it that is going to enable a corporation to use a business service to manage itself better? So we're thinking ahead. We think that there are still perhaps some interesting variations on the search theme. We think that technologies for e-commerce, I think, are interesting. But we're going to go on an off-site in the next week, just before Labor Day, specifically for the purpose of saying what is going to change in our world. And we go on these off-sites. We have them at least once a year. We're all expected to read books. The two books that we're all going to read prior to going to the off-site are Tom Friedman's The World is Flat, because we thought that I read that book and I heard him speak, and I thought he did a marvelous job of doing a short history of technology and how technology really has changed the game. So I think that's a powerful compendium of the history of sort of recent technology, and it helps you think within a framework that enables you to think of what's the next new thing. And then also Blink, by the author of The Tipping Point, which I thought was a great intellectual food for thought. And we're reading that in preparation for our offsite, as well as studying within our portfolio what worked and why, and what didn't work and why. What was it about those things that didn't work? What did they have in common? Was it an industry that was slow to adopt? Was it a technology that was fundamentally flawed? Was it an entrepreneur? So really trying to focus on, from 10,000 feet, what was it that worked in our portfolio and what was it didn't work? What tended to work for us was when we got in early. We saw software as a service early. We saw investing in financial services delivered as an e-commerce solution. We saw that early. Reverse logistics was nothing that other VCs were talking about. So we've done well. We've gotten in early. So we need to step back and think, what will be the next new thing?
Great. Well, I hope we can plug your offsite and hear what you guys come up with.
Sure.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Thank you, Greg. It's been fun. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Hope all of you are ready to invest a couple million in Debbie's next fund. If you're still looking for money of your own, you can log on to venturevoice.com to find links to everything mentioned in this show, especially to Debbie's own firm, Starvest. Maybe you'll be the first company to get invested in by Starvest without having a referral. If you do get funded by her, you better appear on this show. Also on our site, you can leave comments about this show or any other in our comments section, or write us with your thoughts and suggestions at talk@venturevoice.com. We've been getting really a lot of great feedback lately, including one criticizing me for not having enough women on this show, which, as you can tell, we're starting to remedy. We're always striving to be a better podcast, so make sure you keep sending in your thoughts. We are looking and growing in a few other directions too, so keep an eye out for us and keep passing on your ideas. Till next time.